Today on the Lazy RPG Talk Show, we are going to talk about the huge Dungeon Crawl Classics Humble Bundle that's currently available. Worlds Without Number has a system reference document available under the Creative Commons CC0 license. We're going to talk about Wizards of the Coast's recent Do You Like Me poll and what it means for GMs. Hasbro, Chris Cox, the CEO of Hasbro, has talked about artificial intelligence in Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast and Dungeons & Dragons. We're going to dig into that a little bit. Wizards of the Coast is partnering with Start Playing Games for some organized games that they are running. The Daggerheart playtest just came out this past week. The first playtest for Daggerheart. Is it going to kill Dungeons & Dragons? No. Today's big topic is going to be challenging high-level characters in 5e. What are some of the things that we can do that we need to be paying attention to when we want to challenge high-level characters in 5e? And we're going to cover more questions from the March 2024 Patreon Q&A. I'm Mike Shea, your pal from Sly Flourish, here to talk about all things in tabletop role-playing games. This show, like all of the work I do, is brought to you by the patrons of Sly Flourish. Patrons get access to a dedicated Discord server, Uncovered Secrets Volume 1 and 2, the Patreon Q&A, the City of Arches Sourcebook, tons of tools to help you run your games, tons of exclusive adventures, lots of stuff that you get for being a patron of Sly Flourish. To the patrons of Sly Flourish, thank you so much for your outstanding support. Dungeon Crawl Classics is a really interesting, very popular, kind of old school approach towards fantasy role-playing games. Many, many people love them. I've had only the chance to play it once. I would love to play it more. I'd really love to kind of dig into it more. And they have an amazing Humble Bundle going on right now. You can get, it's $40 for 80 items, but that includes a physical book, so you pay shipping, but you get a physical version of Mutant Crawl Classics, which I think is sort of like their take on Gamma World. And I actually think that Gamma World would be a really good, you know, I think that Dungeon Crawl Classics style and Gamma World, I think, mix up very well. But you can get the 79 item bundle for $25. So what's the difference there? So $15 difference. And that gives you all of the stuff in PDF. So you don't have to pay for shipping and you get tons of stuff in PDF. And that includes Dungeon Crawl Classics, the main book. It includes Mutant Crawl Classics, the main book, bunch of adventures, bunch of accessories, bunch of different things that you get for a very, very low price. They also have, if you're really like, well, I just want to get DCC. I just want Dungeon Crawl Classics itself. They have a $1 four-item package that includes Dungeon Crawl Classics and a 20% off coupon on their website. This is all available on Humble Bundle. It is an amazing deal. Tons and tons of different things that you can pick up. There's also, I haven't really looked at like what you get, but $15 for the 12 items, although I think for the other 10 items, $10, you might as well get the 79 item bundle. It looks really cool. Again, very popular RPG. People really, really like it. I wish I had, I dig it. It's definitely a cool RPG. I want to play more of it. I just haven't had a chance to really dive into it, but they've got some really good stuff. I did get a big review sampler box, a great big box full of books from Goodman Games covering all kinds of stuff that they have put out that I'm going to be talking about in future episodes. But I wanted to highlight this excellent mega bundle from Goodman Games, the Dungeon Crawl Classics and Mutant Crawl Classics mega bundle. Really, really good deal. $25, 80 PDFs. That's ridiculous. But the one that really blows me away is, if you want to even take a look at, there is no reason. I can understand you're like, look, I really don't need 80 new PDFs, and I don't know if I like this game at all. And $25 is still $25. There is no reason I can think of to not spend $1 to get the Dungeon Crawl Classics core book plus, you know, a couple of different Dungeon Crawl magazines and a coupon on their website for $1. It's worth, there's no reason not to pick that up. Just try it out. Take a look at it. See if it's an RPG for you. $1 is a fantastic, it's bananas. It's a bananas deal. But if you're looking for more stuff, definitely look at these two other bundles, the $25 79 item bundle, or if you want a physical book of Mutant Crawl Classics, the softcover Mutant Crawl Classics, you can pick that up for $40 plus 79 other products as part of the Humble Bundle Dungeon Crawl Classics Mutant Crawl Classics bundle of holding that is going on now. So Kevin Crawford, a designer that has made numerous role-playing games, including Worlds Without Number, Stars Without Number, and Cities Without Number, a fantasy RPG, a science fiction RPG, and a cyberpunk RPG. Very popular RPGs. And he has released the Worlds Without Number SRD, the system reference document for Worlds Without Number, for free under a Creative Commons CC0 license. This one covers, the system reference document covers all of the core rules for the games that he has published for Worlds Without Number, and is released under CC0. Which means not only can you download it and copy it and send it to your friends and take the text and make tools, you don't even have to reference the original source. It is the lowest level that you can do in the Creative Commons license. You can do anything, pretty much anything you want with it. His reasons for the document was pretty interesting, which he said, I'm pretty sure that from his understanding of how game mechanics work within copyright, I don't think there could be copyrighted anyway. So I'm just saying, hey, regardless of whether or not they can or can't be, because it really hasn't been proven in court, you can just go ahead and use all this stuff. You can use this however you want. It is a 98-page system reference document that covers all manners of the mechanics of his Without Numbers games. It does not have a lot of GM stuff in it. It's got stuff for like making monsters and things like that. But one of the things that those books are known for are the huge piles of random tables that exist in those. Those random tables are not included in the system reference document. But lots and lots of stuff is spell listings and monsters and other aspects of the game are all available in the system reference document under a CC0 license. You can basically do anything that you want with it. It is the Creative Commons equivalent of public domain. It means it's out there. He can never take it back. You can use it however you want. He even says that you may explicitly advertise your products as being compatible with Worlds Without Number. I don't know that you would normally be able to do that other than the fact that he says it in here. So anyway, really, really neat. Released. If you are a game designer and you're looking for some mechanics to kind of dig into to build your own game without having to worry about paying a license fee or being beholden to any particular group, take a look at the Worlds Without Number. It also seems like this is a great way that if you wanted to run Worlds Without Numbers games, you could give this out to your players so they could see how the game works and they can copy it and download it and use it however they want for free. So I thought that was really cool. Very, very generous of Kevin Crawford to take that material and put it out under a CC0 license. Really, really neat stuff. So this, I think, is this past week over social media channels. Wizards of the Coast said, hey, we have a poll, a short poll that we would like you to take. And it was a really kind of bizarre poll because it was all about, like, you know, I'm referring as to the do you like me? Yes, no poll. And it asked a series of questions. We'll actually take a look at those questions today. I've already taken the poll, so I'm not going to submit my results, but I thought it'd be kind of interesting to take a look at the poll itself and talk about it a little bit. When I first saw the poll and looked at it, and I was taking it, my wife was taking it, and we were both like, wow, I really wonder what these results are going to be. And I'm like, well, the bare of it is we're never going to know the results, and they're not going to tell us the answers to these. And then I was like, oh, you know what I could do is I could make a similar poll on like a Google survey, and I could submit it far and wide, and I could ask people to submit it far and wide, and we could probably get thousands and thousands of results back that aren't exactly representative of the exact group that they would hit with this poll. I don't know that our bounds overlap exactly, but we would get some answers and it'd be kind of interesting. And I'm like, yeah, I could do that. I could write up that poll and I could put that out there and I could get thousands of results and I will release the results and I will release the raw results so that people could do analysis on it. If they said this, did they say that? All that kind of stuff. And I'm like, what the hell for? Who cares? The only people who care about this, that really care and where it's really important, is Wizards of the Coast and Hasbro. They're the only ones where this really matters. It doesn't matter to you, and it doesn't matter to me, right? Whether or not I like or don't like D&D or think that D&D is going in good places in the future, or whether you think there's going in good places in the future, that's not actionable information for us. It doesn't change our games. It doesn't change what we like. It doesn't change what we don't like. My answers don't affect your answers. Yours don't affect mine. They don't affect anybody else's. The answer is the only people that this matters to is like the marketing team at Hasbro and Wizards of the Coast. It really doesn't matter to anybody else. So I was like, well, it's interesting. And it would be kind of fun to see the results, but I'm not going to go through the effort of having people sign another poll just so we can figure out what those answers are. When the answers are, it doesn't really matter. But I thought it was, you know, it was still kind of interesting. And I think it, for me, that was sort of the adult conclusion that I came to here, which is why it's fun to kind of dig into all this stuff. Who cares, right? Like, our games are what matter. What happens at our table matters. Me and my five friends that are coming over later today to sit down and play our game. We're actually playing Shadow Dark, but we could be playing D&D. We could be playing anything else. I played a D&D game last night. The results of this poll do not matter to us at all. It really doesn't matter. I do think it's kind of interesting, though, for each of us to kind of explore what our feelings are on this. That as a whole, I don't know that it matters that much. But independently, it kind of does. And I thought, well, I could kind of give some thoughts that I have just to kind of share them. Again, my own opinions, they don't matter to you. You are allowed to have your opinions. I'm sure you do. So I'm not influencing your results on this. I don't, you can kind of have any thought you want on it. But I do think like it's kind of interesting to see what it is. And so here are the questions that they asked, right? Which is like, do you like me? Yes, no. Ask a few questions about Dungeons and Dragons. How do you feel about Dungeons and Dragons? I hate, I don't like, I'm neutral. I like it. I love it. I love D&D. So yeah, I absolutely say I love this game. When was the last time you recommended D&D to someone else? Definitely within the past month. I recommend it all the time. I just recommended the starter set like last week on the show. So I recommend it all the time. Do you think D&D is becoming less popular, more popular, or staying the same? What's interesting is this is one where like Bayesian analysis has to come in, because one thing is we know that D&D has had explosive growth over like the past 5 or 6 years. I think we know that it's relatively slowed down. And one thing about explosive growth is that it cannot sustain itself. If you have exponential growth, you cannot sustain it, because eventually it's like one or two hops out, you hit everybody on the planet. I was listening to a podcast about Apple, and they were saying like, oh, people are upset that Apple sales slowed, and they're like, they slowed because they literally hit everybody who can buy an iPhone has bought an iPhone, or that would want to buy an iPhone has bought an iPhone. No one, it's not like there's anybody that's like, oh, I haven't heard of this iPhone, please tell me about it. It's like, no, they literally, they have 2 billion versions of them out there out of like 7 billion people. So, you know, they're hitting the population of the planet. So in other words, for this answer, I would probably say staying the same is about right, because you're almost saying like, nah, it's got to level off. And you're probably always best, if you're betting money on it, you would bet that it's going to level off. You wouldn't bet that it's going to remain on a great big spike. How do you feel about the current direction of D&D, of the D&D game? Well, that's really funny, because we've been going through the playtest of the 2024 books. I think that the 2024 books are really the only products that Wizards of the Coast is putting out for D&D that actually matter when it comes to the longevity and the health of the hobby. And I haven't really seen them yet. I don't know what they're going to be doing with them. I've seen the playtest stuff. I kind of think that they're going too far with it. I mean, my own impression, other people have their impressions, but I feel like they could have just cleaned things up like other RPG companies have done. Just clean things up, shave off, you know, fix some of the things that we know are problems, kind of smooth and streamline some of the stuff that isn't, but generally keep everything the same. Instead, they got creative and they're adding feats at first level and they're adding all the weapon stuff. The weapon stuff is cool, but like, is that really a core thing that should be in there, or maybe a supplementary thing that should be there? So I'm going to say the current direction, I'm going to say negative. I don't think. Now, I could be wrong and the books could come out and they could be totally awesome, but they're asking me the question now when I don't have the books in hand. How do I feel? That's how I feel. Then they ask about Wizards of the Coast. Same kind of questions. There's only 4, and I got to be careful about submit, because I don't want to submit this because I've already answered the question, and God forbid I should skew the results. A few questions about Wizards of the Coast. How do you feel about Wizards of the Coast? I hate the company. I don't like the company. I'm neutral on this company. I like the company, or I love the company. Now, you don't love companies, man. Like, you know, like I'll give a strong don't love companies. Companies don't love you. They are entities. They have rights. They have legal, in the United States, they have legal rights like they're a person, but they are not a person. They don't love you. Companies don't love you. So don't love them back. Now, you could say like, how do I feel about the stuff that they've done? How do I feel about the stuff that they haven't done? And honestly, I feel pretty neutral about it. And that's because I've seen them do things that have been very good for the hobby. Releasing the system reference document in Creative Commons in 5 different languages, that's a really good thing. Licensing the material out to Foundry and to Roll20, I feel very, I think that is a really good thing. I've seen them having behaviors that have been really strong. On the other side, I've seen them do things that were really bad. I'm never going to forget about the OGL catastrophe. I'm just not, right? I don't know. There's no way for me to know that they have changed the company to ensure that doesn't happen again, or something like it doesn't happen again. So I, you know, that is a permanent mar as far as I'm concerned. And then the firing felt really bad to me, because I felt like a bunch of D&D designers got fired because Transformers did badly. And that's where I went on my whole, there is no Wizards of the Coast, there is only Hasbro. We're going to come back to that in a minute. Honestly, I feel pretty neutral. I would say neutral. When was the last time you recommended Wizards of the Coast? I don't think a Wizards of the Coast product, that's kind of cheap, because I recommended the starter set. I guess that counts. So I would say in the past month, I've recommended it. Do you think Wizards of the Coast is becoming less popular, more popular, or staying the same? I would almost certainly say less popular. I am being influenced by all the social media stuff that I see. I think it's probably very fair to say that the majority of people who are involved in buying Dungeons & Dragons products don't really feel anything about the company whatsoever. So it probably is staying the same. In fact, I'd be more likely to say it's staying the same. But I can tell you that like their reputation online is not great. And so I would still probably say becoming less popular. How do you feel about the current direction of Wizards of the Coast? I gotta go with negative. And that's because, and we'll come to it. You know, there's some interesting stuff that happened, but I would generally say I feel negative about it. I don't feel strongly negative because, again, they've done some really good things. But I do feel like we heard from the executive staff, and we're going to talk about what we've heard from some of the executives in a minute here. That happened 2 days after they put out this poll. But generally speaking, they're talking about monetization. And we saw Penny Arcade was talking about this, the idea of leveraging user-created content. Well, what does leverage mean? That means how do we charge money for you making creative stuff at home? They're definitely interested in that. And they're a commercial company, and therefore we shouldn't love them. And we shouldn't love them because we know that their best interests are not in making the game strong. Their best interests aren't in making the hobby strong. Their best interests are in making money. They want to make money. They want to return value to their shareholders. They will do anything that they can do that. They are under the charge of their shareholders to do that. So, no. So, you're right. So, how do I feel about the current direction? I definitely feel negative about it. So, that's how I feel. But that doesn't... So, I say all that. Who cares? I guess I just spent, 5 minutes on the show talking about it. I don't think it really matters that much. I don't think that my opinions should affect your opinions. Your opinions shouldn't affect mine. I would say pretty strongly, don't love a company. Love the game. Totally, you can love D&D. Totally, you can love tabletop role-playing games. You can love the specific products that you're picking up. Don't love a company because they do not love you. 2 days after this, there was an article on VentureBeat where Chris Cox, Hasbro's CEO, was talking about a whole bunch of stuff, and he talked about Baldur's Gate. Boy, they bring up Baldur's Gate. I wonder how long they're going to bring Baldur's Gate up as a profit thing. And then they came to artificial intelligence. And he had some things to say about artificial intelligence, and he had some specific things to say about artificial intelligence in Dungeons & Dragons. GameBeat said on AM particular, there was an interesting example today, a Wheel of Time franchise having its own large language model. Is that it's an interesting response on the topic of both responsible AI and respecting IP, making sure that only licensed things can go into an LLM. This particular solution is to put only that IP into LLM. Does that sound at all appealing to the franchise? And he says, first off, we're doing R&D efforts around AI. And he said we have multiple AI things. I don't know if he said it exactly here. Most of the major entertainment and IP holders are at least thinking about it. Blah, 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 blah. I don't think we can be very cavalier about how we think about AI. That said, it's exciting. There's lots of potential for delighting audiences. There's like some CEO speak, but he's a CEO. What are you going to do? I need to make sure we do it in a way that respects the creators we work with. Blah, 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 blah. We can leverage that. He talks about D&D. D&D has 50 years of content that we can mine. Look at that. D&D has 50 years of content that we can mine. So anyway, you can read the article. It's linked in the show notes. It's another one where it's like, is this a candle going out? Not really. Not for me. I mean, like, he's a CEO. He's going to say CEO stuff. I get it. The one thing that chaps my ass a little bit about this, he's going to say things, he's going to do company stuff, whatever. The thing that chaps my ass about this is I spent a day in their community summit last year where they said very specifically, AI does not have a place in our D&D creative process. They said that. They said that out loud. There were like 40 people there. I went, and you'll find a link to EN World's description of the summit where they specifically said that. They specifically said, because they know everybody that was at that summit, most everybody at that summit, either didn't care or was really against them using any kind of generative AI or using AI stuff. Now, were they talking about art? But they were talking about words, too. They weren't just talking about art when they brought it back. But, you know, the reality is like, so they went through this whole seminar, right? We all spent all this time on. I spent a day. I really regret having spent a day in that seminar. And I would really consider it again, whether I would ever do something like that again. Because they just lied to us. They manipulated us the whole time. Like, they got people that really believe the things that they said. But boy, the disconnect between the executive staff at Hasbro, the executive staff of Wizards of the Coast, and the people that are actually working on D&D and the summit attendees could not have been more stark when I was there. And now we're seeing, they were just paying lip service. Of course, they're going to look at AI, right? They posted this. I went and dug up this tweet. No one at Wizards of the Coast is working on AI DMs. We love our human DMs too much. If you're looking for a DM, we suggest heading to our Discord. Now, of course, we're not saying an AI DM. We're saying just AI for other things. But come on, they're making the impression that AI does not have a place. And clearly it does. So what conclusion can we make from this? I come back to the same conclusion I had. Now, of course, I just went and sought evidence that helped reinforce my opinion. I don't know how I'm wrong. There is no Wizards of the Coast. There is only Hasbro. You can have a team that absolutely loves Dungeons and Dragons. And I know they do. I know the team of designers and developers and editors and artists that are working on D&D love D&D. I'm absolutely convinced of that. They also get a paycheck. And on that paycheck stub, at the top of the paycheck, it says Hasbro. Hasbro runs the show. Hasbro decides whether or not you have to cut 20% of your staff. Hasbro decides if you're going to be investigating artificial intelligence or not. They decide whether and how much and money you're going to put towards a 3D virtual tabletop. They decide a lot of that stuff. The executive staff decides a lot of that kind of stuff. And that's what's going to affect it. So don't love the company. And there is only Hasbro when it comes to D&D. And instead, what should we do? We should strengthen our own grip in the hobby. I've talked about this all the time. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to dig into it too much now. Find your own way to love the hobby, regardless of what any company does. Love the game. Love your version of the game. It's not affected by anybody else and in anybody else's decision. Strengthen your own relationship with the tabletop role-playing game industry so no one company can make a bonehead decision that makes your relationship with the hobby weaker. Wizards of the Coast did have an interesting thing. They are partnering with Start Playing Games. I thought this was actually very good. I don't think, in the same way that I don't think that Chris Cox talking about using artificial intelligence in D&D is necessarily a candle going out, because I think them doing so, maybe somebody will argue this with me, and I can change my mind about any of this stuff. If you want to argue with me, become a patron, and then join the Discord server, and you can talk with me all the day long. We have lots of people in the Discord server to talk about a lot of this stuff. And I guess my argument would be, I don't see them investigating artificial intelligence as being a candle that goes out. It is probably a candle that goes out for certain people who really are against AI. They really think generative AI is terrible. And trust me, I understand their arguments. And I think that many of their arguments are completely sound. But I don't see it as like Wizards investigating this doesn't feel like it's hurting the entire TTRPG hobby. If they were to like create an LLM based on all of their D&D products that you could go on D&D Beyond and you could ask it questions and it could answer D&D questions, how is that directly hurting the rest of the TTRPG hobby is the question that I've got. I'm not saying it's good for them to do that, but I don't know that I necessarily can see how that damages the entire hobby currently. That's the big question I have. In the same way, I don't know that this one lights a candle, but it is something that I really thought was interesting, which is that Wizards of the Coast, Dungeons and Dragons, Hasbro has partnered with Start Playing Games, an independent company that brings GMs and players together, mostly for individual played game or paid game services, so that they can run a D&D service. They have a $10 off coupon, so you can get $10 off the game when you're doing it. What I like about this is this shows an example of where Hasbro, Wizards of the Coast, Dungeons and Dragons is partnering with other groups to say, hey, they already have a whole system for bringing GMs and players together in this environment. Why don't we capitalize on that rather than trying to build our own? I think that's a strong way to go. That is a strong way of kind of reinforcing the community of saying we are now building partnerships with other independent groups in order to do things like bring D&D to these other groups. I like that, right? In the same way that I don't think it's quite as important as them, for example, licensing their content out to Foundry. But I think it's good that they're partnering with other organizations and doing this. So I was generally pleased with this. I don't know that I would say this is making the entire TTRPG hobby stronger, because I don't know that Start Playing Games has the same kind of importance and impact that something like owning your own gaming material and ensuring that you can keep it, even if the company decides they no longer want to sell it, that has, right? The platform lock-in is something that I'm always cognizant of. And this isn't really about platform lock-in, because you're just going to Start Playing Games to sign up for games. But if you really like Start Playing Games, if you're a GM that runs it, this is a really good benefit for you to be able to play official D&D games. I mean, you can play them anyway, but now there's this kind of partnership that's going on there. So I was happy to see that. I thought that was pretty good. Daggerheart, Darrington Press, the press version of Critical Role, just released the playtest for Daggerheart. Daggerheart is their long-form RPG. Their version of D&D, right? They want to have a long form campaign with crunchier mechanics, the kind of stuff that we would see Matt Mercer running as part of Critical Role. I'm not saying, I don't know if he's switching to Daggerheart or not. There's a lot of why would he? I don't know. We'll see. It's not a one-shot narrative kind of RPG. It is definitely meant for a longer campaign D&D style game where you're watching your characters grow over time. I've only just touched on it. And my only recommendation to you is there is no reason, just in the same way that there's no reason for you to not spend a dollar to go buy Dungeon Crawl Classics to see if you like it, see what you dig. This one is absolutely free. There's no reason for you to not go on either DriveThruRPG or on the Daring to Press website and go and download it. First of all, it's a ton of material. It's got an entire sort of quick start adventure that you can get. First of all, it looks really good, right? Like even the layout and the design and the art and everything, this looks way better than I would expect a typical playtest guide to work. This is really neat. It's a way to teach players how to play by having this thing they call the slider. So you have a sheet of paper that sits underneath your character sheet and you slide it out to the left and right, and it gives you like pop-up instructions for what each of the sections of the character sheet are. Full color stuff. You can get a feeling for what, you know, for how the game works, how it plays out. Looks really interesting. I haven't played it. And I do feel like in order for me to really understand what this game is like, I would need to sit down and play it. So maybe if I have an opportunity to sit down and actually play a session of this to get a feeling, I think that will give me a better idea of what Daggerheart looks like. But it looks really strong to me. It looks really cool. And again, for the playtest guide is just packed with stuff. It's got GM materials. It's got player materials. It's got just, you know, tons and tons of material for you to be able to play. Character sheets, you know, all kinds of stuff that they are giving away, right, as part of the playtest. Now, the interesting thing is they really do describe this as like, we want you to chew on this. We want feedback. We know that there's editing problems. We know that there's mechanic problems. We want you to tell us what's going on with it, because they're not even publishing the game until 2025. They're a full year away before the actual game comes out. And yet it looks really strong at the same time. So I think it's really cool. Again, there's no reason to not download it and take a look at it. What's interesting is how the members of the TTRPG community and outside people from the TTRPG community are talking about this. Oh, by the way, there's a couple of really good videos about how to build characters, what the game is about, how to build characters. And then Critical Role did both a character building session and an actual one shot where they ran it. So if you want to watch the Critical Role staff in their incredible studio with the people that, you know, people that you love from Critical Role playing it, there's a bunch of videos where you can see that. So again, you can get a really good feeling for how people are digging into this and what this game looks like. But it's been interesting to see the result. And on one side, I have seen lots of people who look at some of the mechanics and say, oh, this is terrible. I really hate it. I saw one post and I was like, oh, come on. And the post was, do these people even play a TTRPG? Yeah, let's ask the designers from, you know, let's ask Critical Role and the owners of Critical Role and the designers of this RPG whether they've ever played an RPG before. Now, they were obviously being sarcastic, but come on. How about instead you look at it and say, well, reading it, it doesn't look like it's for me. Oh, cool, right? If it's not for you, it's not for you. And I've seen other people, good on them. I saw people in this chat just now saying, hey, I took a look at it. I read it. It really doesn't look like it's for me. Bingo, no problem. Not everything has to be for everybody. We got tons of options available. For me, I don't know if it's for me yet, and I wouldn't really know until I actually sat down and play it. And I'll play anything, right? I'll try a session of pretty much any RPG. So on one side, we have kind of people who are like, oh, I think it's really unfinished, or I really don't like how they did this, or it's going to be too complicated, or it's too hard for the GMs, or lots and lots of arguments about why the game is bad. And then the other side, I see nothing but this is going to kill D&D. And in fact, you're like, okay, well, obviously any person who is like, oh, Daggerheart's going to kill D&D probably doesn't understand this industry very well, in my argument, that even as popular as it could be, is it going to eclipse D&D? No. Right. And Teos Abadia from Alpha Stream has a wonderful blog post where he talks about, like, every time he ever hears somebody say it's going to kill D&D, how ridiculous that whole idea is. However, we see it in things like Business Insider. Business Insider says, and I don't know, this actually insults Business Insider, right? The 8 people who made Dungeons and Dragons cool just launched their answer to the game. Hasbro and its empire should be very, very nervous. Come on. Well, how ridiculous is that, right? This is a headline article on Business Insider. D&D's most famous players have an answer to the game they've been playing on Twitch since 2015. The cast of Critical Role launched the open beta. These are all true. And then here's where you get the what? D&D publisher Wizards of the Coast, a subsidiary of gaming giant Hasbro, should be afraid. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Give me a break. Daggerheart can be hugely successful, and it's not going to eclipse D&D. And here's something else. It doesn't freaking matter. It doesn't matter. There'll be plenty of people playing D&D. There'll be plenty of people playing Daggerheart. There's plenty of people playing lots of different RPGs. When you buy a physical book and it's sitting in your house and you find five friends that want to play it, that's as successful as it needs to be. It doesn't matter. But I just, you know, I couldn't help but like, oh man. So you're going to, you know, there's other videos like, oh, is Daggerheart going to kill D&D? No, it's not. It's almost certainly not. Could it happen one day? Maybe. Is this going to be it? No, probably not. It's going to be really strong. You know it's going to do it. Not everybody has to aim for that, right? Like Critical Role is hugely successful. Multi-million dollar company. Amazon cartoon series that they're running. Ton, you know, that's like the most popular streaming game in existence. Probably responsible for a lot of the drive of what brought people to D&D over the past 7 years, right? So tremendous. Tremendous growth. You know what they aren't? A multi-billion dollar company with a multi-billion dollar marketing team. You know, they don't have all of that. So don't worry about it. But don't worry about it is my point. It doesn't matter either way, but it's not going to, and that doesn't matter. Let me take a quick break and tell you about the sale of the Lazy DM's Companion. The Lazy DM's Companion, my book that I kickstarted about 3 years ago, that is one of my favorite books that I've put out, a book that gives you tools and tables and guidelines and inspiration for generating your adventures while you're prepping your game, is now on sale. It is $5 off either version of the book. So the PDF version is $5, so 50% off the PDF version, 20% off the soft cover and PDF version. This is only happening for a few more days. It ends on the 21st of March. So if you are listening to this and you want to pick up this book, this is the best time to pick up the book. You can find a link to the Lazy DM's Companion on sale at the Sly Flourish bookstore in the show notes. I love random tables. I use random tables a lot to help fire my imagination off while I'm trying to come up with new ideas. I love books of random tables, and I have lots of them. There are certain times where I just can't find the exact kind of random table that I want. A lot of times I see random tables that are either too big in scope and scale or too granular. So on one side, you'll get this sort of like wide rolls where you roll all these things about empires and kingdoms and religions, and you're like, well, none of that actually gets me anywhere in my game. And then on the other side, you get random tables that are like, let's talk about each particular piece of silverware that you might find on a table and why they're all different. And that's too granular. Finding the right resolution, I'm using resolution like the computer graphics term, finding the right resolution for a random table is actually pretty hard. How do I find a table that gives me enough information that it's specific and actionable for the game I'm going to run, but not so granular that I have to roll 1,000 times in order to get something useful? That's a trick that I have. So this is something I definitely kept in mind when I was writing the Lazy DM's Companion, that trying to find the right resolution of the random tables in that book to make sure that you had the kind that was directly actionable and useful for you to prepare and run your games, but not so detailed that it would take you a million years of rolling on a bunch of nested random tables to come up with something. That was something I kept very much in mind. One type of random table that I looked far and wide, and I'm sure I missed some. I'm sure there are people out there that could tell me, but I have lots and lots of RPG books in my library, and I looked through lots and lots of different role-playing, lots of different random tables. And one of the things that I found missing was a Dungeon Chambers table. There were some that had them. Actually, the 2014 Dungeon Master's Guide has a pretty good set, but it's a relatively limited set, and I wanted a little bit more. I came up with 15 different types of dungeons that the characters might be exploring, and 20 chambers that you might find in those dungeons for each one of them, for a total of 300 different potential kinds of chambers that you might find in various dungeons. The intention of this is to fuel your ideas when you have a map in front of you. Let's say you went and grabbed a Dyson Logos map and you want to fill in the rooms with interesting things that help you in your adventure. The intention is that if depending on the kind of lair that you're creating, the kind of dungeon that you're creating, you can use this as inspiration to give you ideas about what you want to put in there. Now you can mix it with other tables like monster tables or monument tables or treasure tables or other kinds of tables so that you can really sort of change these. One good trick with these tables, I guess I'll come to how to use these. So what are some examples? So we have beast lairs, castles, caverns, derelict ships, dragons lairs, manors, mines, necropolises, prisons, sewers, sunken grotto, unholy temple, thieves den, wizard's lair, and forgotten vaults. And one of the ways that I laid this out, this is actually feedback that I got from some of the fine patrons of Sly Flourish, was how about making the earlier chambers chambers a little bit more mundane and the later chambers a little bit, you know, crazier or more thematic. That way, if you're looking for more standard chambers, you can roll a lower die, like roll a D8 or roll a D10, maybe roll a D12. But then if you want to get into some of the crazier chambers, you could roll a D20 and hit a mixture of the mundane plus crazy. Obviously, if you want just crazy ones, you can like roll a D10 plus 10 and it goes to just that side. But really, my expectation isn't that you're rolling on this list at all. My expectation is that you're reading through this list when you're filling out a lair and it's giving you ideas about chambers that you want to drop in, or spawning your own ideas about chambers that aren't necessarily on this list. So that's the intention of how it works. But one cool thing that you can do with this list is mix it with other tables. So you can mix it up with random monster tables. You can mix it up with random monuments. But one of the things that I think is really useful is having your own personal random list of factions. So think about your own campaign. Write down the major players, the major factions. These could be religious orders. They could be groups of bad guys. They could be any sort of organizations that exist either in the past or in the current that you think could be tied to one of the locations. And you can roll these and then roll on that list. And it will give you things like a crew quarters, sure, but it's a crew quarters of Asmodeus. Like Asmodeus cultists operate in this crew quarters. Now, maybe you would do that for the whole dungeon. So your whole dungeon is a derelict ship of Asmodeus. And then you can take the crew quarters part, you can take all the chambers and flavor them with the fact that they're all tied to a faction. That probably works better than trying to have a separate faction for every individual room. But if you have something like a storage hold, you can take a storage hold, but then also go to the monuments table, which I had shown on a previous show, and you could roll a monument and say, well, there is a nest, you know, there is like a celestial nest inside of your storage hold. Well, what's that doing there, right? If it's a derelict ship, it could kind of make sense as you get these weird things. So the idea of taking these chambers and mixing them with other random tables is really how that's going to work. Where can you get this? So these dungeon chambers are available to patrons of Sly Flourish. Patrons get access to a book called Uncovered Secrets Volume 2. This is sort of the extended guide of the sorts of things you would find in the Lazy DM's Companion. It has lots and lots of different things that are going on, lots of different sort of tools and tricks and tips. Some of the stuff that got cut from the Lazy DM's Companion when we made it, but other ones are things that have come out since. The two newest ones are the 1D100 Monuments, which I talked about on a previous show, and this new Dungeon Chambers table. They're designed to fit on a single sheet, two sides of a single sheet of paper, or you can print out two pages. I printed out double-sided and then stuck it in my paper Trapper Keeper, D&D Trapper Keeper notebook. So at any time, if I need to fill out a lair, I can look at it and say, oh, they found an old manor. What kind of rooms might they find in the manor? A study, a library, a bathing room, a master closet, a pantry, a family altar, a hidden library, a safe room, an art gallery. You have all these different ideas that you can do to kind of fill out chambers in your dungeon. So that's available to patrons of Sly Flourish. I hope you'll check it out. Today's big topic is challenging high-level characters. This one came to me because I ran in my Empire of the Ghouls game a great big battle against six 12th-level PCs. This is 5th edition PCs. For this campaign, we are using the 2014 D&D Player's Handbook. We are using the Tome of Heroes from Kobold Press, and we are using Midgard Heroes. So the kind of character options that are available are different than you might have if you're using other kinds of character options for your 5th edition games. And in this game, I threw the kitchen sink at them. So it was an interesting battle because they were fighting lots and lots and lots of ghouls, because they're in Empire of the Ghouls. They're in the final part of Empire of the Ghouls. And as you can imagine, in an adventure called Empire of the Ghouls, there are a lot of ghouls, and there were a lot of ghouls, but they were like ghoul death knights, not death knights, but they were like, you know, ghoul black guards and ghoul wizards. I think they had five CR8 monsters and a whole bunch of CR4s, and then a great big pile of CR1s. And the CR1s were intended to just be wiped out quickly, but it made sense that there was a big pile of armored ghouls in there. So they killed the armored ghouls without any big problem. And then they fought these other ones. But one spell kind of disrupted the entire battle, and it was a spell I totally didn't expect to disrupt the whole battle, and that was Sunbeam. Now, I only ever really became aware of Sunbeam because of Baldur's Gate 3, and I think the same is true with my players. We're like, wow, Sunbeam is really good. It's like a lightning bolt you get to fire every round. But the interesting thing about Sunbeam is that it radiates daylight in an area regardless of the fact that you're firing the Sunbeam. And ghouls have a sunlight sensitivity. So it meant all of the ghouls that were near this guy who was firing off the Sunbeam had disadvantage on all attacks. And the characters all have pretty high armor classes, and the ghouls are running in and attacking him, and they all just missed almost all the time. Now, I did drop. They did have a very powerful ghoul necromancer who dropped one of the characters pretty easily, and some of the other characters definitely took some damage. But like, we had one, the guy who was firing the sunbeam. I think I rolled 9 to 12 attacks, and none of them hit. And it's because he has both a really high armor class, and they were at disadvantage on all their attacks. And boy, it totally changed things. And I realized at that moment that up until that moment in my Empire of the Ghouls game, I've had a pretty easy time making sure that the challenge of the game was solid by just throwing straight Forge of Foes kind of monsters where you have monsters with a lot of hit points that do a lot of damage, and I didn't have to worry about it. But that was the first time when I was like, wow, if I only really have one more big battle that I expect to run. But when I'm running that big battle, I'm going to have to do more homework than I did in this battle, because this battle wasn't particularly, given the amount of the damage threat, the battle was, you know, I don't think really provided the same threat I would have expected. Did it have to? No. And actually, one of the things I wish I had done was, in the flavor of the story, showed how powerful that ability was, that the ghouls, this radiant light was shining out from Durham, the cleric who fired off the sunbeam, and he's blasting through them, firing this ray that's incinerating, and how they would have just been, you know, this is one of the strongest groups of ghouls in the entire city, and they're just getting destroyed by the power of the characters. I wish I'd leaned in on that description, because it didn't matter in the end, right? But I wanted to show the players how good they were. Instead of them feeling like they managed to work an angle, I really wanted them to enjoy getting that blast off. But as the characters reach higher levels, we start to see times where the types of threat that we would normally be able to apply to characters in D&D just don't apply anymore. And that idea of, like, if you give creatures enough attacks with enough damage, eventually you're going to be able to do enough that it's going to matter, kind of falls off when the characters have lots and lots of ways to mitigate damage, give disadvantage to their opponents, stay out of the a way of attacks, and really just avoid things. That threat really kind of disappears. The other big problem with it is there are ways to certainly bring a lot of threat to the characters, but it almost always equates to time, that the battle is going to get longer. And it's really hard. And this is the thing I haven't yet figured out, is how do you keep the threat up against characters and still keep the duration of the battle relatively low against high level characters? If you have 6 12th level PCs, they actually got 13th. So now I've got 6 13th level PCs. Is there a way to give a high threat to them that doesn't feel like BS? You don't want to feel like you're just making stuff up to hurt them. That doesn't mean the battle goes on very long. Because I knew this battle was going to take forever. I told them, like, it's going to be like a 2-hour fight. And it was. It was a 2-hour fight. They ended it right at the end of the session. They had about an hour getting there, and then a big 2-hour battle. And it was fun. And I don't think anybody was, like, everybody was into it. And they knew what was coming. And the battle evolved, and things shifted. And they had a lot of neat advantages that were going on. One thing is they had a control amulet for two frost giant skeletons that they were able to manipulate on top of everything else. And that really made the battle more interesting. But it was really long. So that's this hard thing, is like, how do you keep the threat high and also not make the battle explode in the amount of time that it takes? Really, really an issue. I have talked about this before. This is something that I've struggled with my whole D&D career for 30 years. 35 years, this has been a problem that I've dealt with in second edition, third edition, fourth edition, fifth edition, and other RPGs. Some RPGs I found to be better at it than others. There's some where, like, the way that the battle scaled, the way that the math scales means you never really have to worry about the big threat changing. But in D&D in particular, the crunchier D&D got, the more this became a particular issue where time spent was really a problem and keeping that threat high. Probably the best resource I have to kind of talk about this, well, we talk about it a lot in Forge of Foes. So Forge of Foes has a lot of articles that talk about ways to keep the threat high, why it's an issue, the quadratic equation, you know, the quadratic growth of power of the characters that they get to higher levels. We have lots of discussion on that. I also have an article called The Collected Experiences Running D&D 5e Boss Fights, which talks about when you're running big boss fights, what is going on. This article is now actually 7 years old. That's kind of interesting. It's probably due for a rewrite. I probably should go back and rewrite this again, but I think I did. I think we did. Scott Gray and Teo Sabadia and myself all wrote about this in Forge of Foes. But, you know, this is one area where I had polled a bunch of people to say, like, how do you keep boss fights working? What are some of the things that you could do to make sure that your boss fights stay threatening but still engaging and interesting? And a lot of them said more monsters, that more monsters are more important than big monsters. And that's a big lesson. In this case, like, it didn't work for me because I had lots of monsters. It wasn't one big monster. It was many, many small monsters. But more monsters are better than fewer monsters, because you're you're going to spread the damage of the characters out rather than them focusing on one guy, and you have more actions to take. So the actions are more evenly distributed over a larger number of monsters, but it definitely increases the length of time that a battle will take. Drain character resources before the fight. Make sure they don't just walk into the whole thing fresh, that they've had some kind of series of battles that they've gone through, they've expended resources. I don't tend to think about that. I don't worry about the number of encounters per day, but that means many times the circumstances will be that by the time they get to a big boss fight, they will have gone through a bunch of other fights. In this case, they had gone through a bunch of other fights. It had been a long time since they took a short rest, but they knew to hang on to their top end spells. And when you have a spell like Sunbeam, where you only need to cast it once and you can keep it going for a whole battle, even that one with their drained resources, they still did it. Using the environment. How do you make the environment challenging in itself? And this is something that Teos Abadia talks about. And I wish I was as good as Teos was at this. Teos had mentioned that he has always been able to find a way in the battles that he creates, in the big challenging fights that he creates, to know that the characters cannot behave optimally. They can't set themselves up perfectly, either through terrain or through the monster types and the positioning of the monsters or the goal of the battle. He's always been able to manipulates things so that the players and the characters have to kind of not act in a perfectly optimal method to go to succeed in the fight. And I presume doing so in a way that isn't just frustrating. Oh, I never get to use my cool thing. So it's not just shutting down the character's abilities. It's just making sure they're not always in this perfect formation, in the perfect position, in the perfect situation with the perfect spells to be able to do everything. That making the fight different enough that they have to approach things. Things like, hey, there's some sniper up there up on a high spot who's invisible. We can't target him with anything that targets something we can see. And he's improved invisible, which means he's hammering us with spells. He's getting advantage on all attacks. He's hitting us like a freight train. And, you know, somebody's got to go up there and take care of that dude, right? And somebody, you can't just hug the doorway. Someone's going to have to go up there and do it. I'm usually a little bit more obtuse about it. Like, you know, I set the characters up like, you can't go back out the back door, right? Like, why? Like, you just can't, right? There's fire. There's a big firewall back there. You can't do it. But using the environment is another one. And actually, terrain features are something where you can have, and this is a trick I do, you go into a chamber and there's a big unholy effigy and radiant energy or unholy energy is flowing off of this effigy. And all of the undead have advantage on all attacks. And now it's like, well, now they are hitting us. And even if we give them disadvantage, they're still now have normal attacks. But we've got to take care of that effigy. And maybe the effigy is far away. Maybe it has its own hit points and armor class and stuff like that. And so they're expending resources to destroy the effigy in order to get the monsters to not have advantage. Because that's going to be really tough when all the monsters have advantage or all the undead have advantage in this area. But then it shakes them up, right? A, the threat is higher. B, they have another thing that they have to attack that isn't just the monsters, stuff like that. A big one, and many people brought this up when I brought this up on YouTube recently, is focusing on the story-based challenge. Instead of worrying about armor class and attacking saving throws and making sure the damage is up, that the kind of battles that are going on shouldn't just be like a civil war fight of one side on one line fighting another side on the other line. There should be other threats at play. There should be hostages that you have to worry about. There should be artifacts that are growing in power that if you don't stop them are going to be devastating. That you attack story elements, not characters. So what are the major threats that they have to worry about? What are things that are going on in the world that you can manipulate that mean the characters can't just fight a big boss? Right? That's a big one, is like, you know, focusing on the story-based challenges, not just the characters' challenges. Improving boss tactics. We can actually change this to just improving tactics overall. And this is something I didn't do. Me being very lazy, I was like, I'm just going to grab some CR8 Forge of Foes stat blocks. And I gave him like little onesie and twosie things. I never said like, oh, well, wait a minute. These guys really should have some ability that shows as a CR8 what makes them really powerful. And hell, I wrote a book. You know, myself and Scott and Tails wrote a book full of monster powers I could have used, and I just didn't use them because I was lazy. When we hit 12th and 13th level, now it's time for me to start using those abilities. What is like a common ability or one ability that I can give to a particular monster type that makes it particularly effective in battle? And you don't want to be too narrow about what it can do, but an example would be that unholy necromancers can do a version of a necrotic fireball that attacks constitution instead of dexterity and can restrain those who fail the saving throw for one turn. That would be a kind of an ability that you could give to a CR8 necromancer that kind of makes sense around their story and also provides a significant threat against like those who are able to, you know, take zero damage on a dexterity saving throw from damage or their constitution saving throw, like like all of their other saves are pretty good, or their armor class is really high, that you want to give them abilities that are asymmetric to the threat and to the defense that the characters have, so that it can be interesting. But you don't, you want to be careful with this, because you don't want to remove agency. You don't want to say like, oh, because you took a high armor class, I'm never going to attack you again. You don't want to do that. You want to show the fact that they have a high armor class. You want to have them get attacked over and over again, and then talk about the frustration that the monsters have not being able to hit, and make the player feel good about that. But at the other side, you also want to make sure that the threat is high by saying, like, yeah, you don't have to worry about this blackguard who's attacking you over and over again and not able to hit because of the A, you're in sunlight, and B, your armor class is really high. But that necromancer over there is hammering you with his con save stuff, right? That is a way that you can sort of balance threat, still give the agency to the characters and the players for why they made the choices they made, but also keeping the threat up at the same time. It's a very careful balance, and it's very difficult to do. And that's that understanding the capabilities of the characters. And of course, you can increase hit points, but again, that gets to level. So that's an example from, again, 7 years ago on boss fights, which I think still stands. Again, we have better chapters of it in Forge of Foes that describe this kind of thing as well. Let's see, we're going to kill that. Yeah, so this idea of like attacking several vectors, I think, is a big one. And it definitely matters. This is an interesting thing because of the way that Wizards of the Coast is starting to design D&D monsters, where many of the magical attacks of creatures are now armor class attacks. They kind of got away from doing saving throw based attacks for a lot of monsters, by particularly for spell casting monsters, because they no longer use traditional spells and instead have spell like abilities. A lot of times those spell like abilities are hitting armor class, which means when characters increase their armor classes, they're going to be even harder to threaten because of those monsters. So when we're designing monsters, or we're designing battles, we want to make sure that we are attacking multiple threat vectors, like multiple spots. And the examples, the easy ones are attack other saving throws that have saving throws against not just con and dexterity. Con and dexterity and wisdom are the common ones, but what about strength saving throws? What about charisma saving throws? What about intelligence saving throws? Like, you can hit all six of those saving throws, and it's unlikely all characters are good at all six of those. Now, you get some tricky bits like the paladins, who give their proficiency bonus to the saves of everybody. You're always going to have stuff like that, but then they chose that, and that's how that works. But, you know, so thinking about how you are able to not just have damage done to characters by attacking their armor class, that's something we need to think about. That's something I need to think about as we get into higher level play. This idea of like meaningful tactical disruptive monster powers. I like the idea that when you have a normal monster, it probably has one ability, and especially a higher CR monster. Lower CR monsters, you could just let them attack, right? They could just attack and do damage. But higher monsters like CR 5 and above, they probably have to have something. And if they're not a boss, you probably only really need to give them one thing, but you might want to give them at least one thing. And again, I would pick something that is likely to challenge the characters, that probably attacks a different vector than armor class and can shake things up. And that idea of like a, you know, I like my idea of I wish I'd used it, right? A necrotic fireball. It's great big area effect. It attacks con instead of dex. And if you fail your save, you're restrained until the end of the necromancer's next turn. Would be a really powerful ability that can offset some of the other things that are going on that could be disruptive. A big common thing I got, which I have used and recommend myself, is waves of combatants. That instead of having like a battle that you've got your bad guys and your good guys and they're having a big fight, that you instead throw waves of combatants. And there's a whole article, again, another chapter in Forge of Foes, where we talk about running waves of combatants. The only issue with waves is they definitely make battles longer. So it works really well for boss fights. It doesn't work well for threatening the characters in a small amount of time, which I don't really have fantastic advice for. Changing terrain, I talked about that idea of building terrain features that benefit the monsters early, but then the characters can turn around. Again, you have like this unholy obelisk in the center. It's radiating necrotic energy that's giving all the undead creatures in there advantage on all of their attacks. But if clerics are able to channel radiant energy into it, or they do enough damage to it, or they, you know, succeed on skill checks, it switches around, and now all of the radiant energy, any radiant based attack has advantage on them. They lose their advantage, and now they are vulnerable to radiant damage or something like that. So how do you make like a switch in the room where it favors the monsters and then switches over and favors the characters? That can be really fun. And the advantage of that is it's a good way to reduce the time as well. That if you make it really hard up front, and then at a certain point in the game it switches over and now they've lost their advantages and they take extra damage from like radiant damage, now the battle's going to end. So that gives you a little bit of time as well. That's that idea of flippable monuments. A big thing is it's very easy, and I think it's a common DM trait to offset the abilities that characters have and kind of fight against them. And I think instead we want to do a little bit of both leaning in and fighting against. You want to have monsters with abilities that are effective against the characters, but you also want the characters and the players to recognize the advantages that they have taken. And this is idea of lightning rods. And you can have lightning rods, typically a lightning rod is a creature that is designed specifically to be very vulnerable to certain character abilities. A horde of monsters that are attacking you in a 20-foot radius is a good example. Oh, they all have 15 hit points, or they all have 12 hit points, and they're all running in and attacking at once. And you're like, you can blast them with a fireball and kill all of them. That works really well. Another one would be great big brutes that have terrible wisdom saves so that you can banish them really easily. That's an example of a lightning rod. But another kind of lightning rod are the attackers, where they attack, they have a lot of attacks, their attack bonus isn't great, and they're going to miss you all the time, but they're attacking and missing and missing and missing and missing, and you're like, yeah, look at this armor class, I'm not getting hit. That's an example of a lightning rod that works. So we want to recognize the advantages that the characters have chosen when they are making their, when they're building their characters, when they're suiting up their characters in higher levels. We want to ensure that we're not just going against that stuff. We kind of want to mix it up, that we want to have some creatures that are like designed to show how well their abilities are, and then other ones that are designed to still threaten them even when they have those abilities. So that's just some of my thoughts, my current thoughts. I'm probably going to write another Sly Flourish article about this. I'm going to dig into what we wrote about it in Forge of Foes. I'm going to examine my own experiences now that I'm running a high-level campaign again, and probably put together a short newsletter article. Again, if you want to see this, please subscribe to the Sly Flourish newsletter, and you'll see that. And maybe we'll talk about it again on the show. But hopefully this gave you some thoughts and some ideas about how to keep the threat of monsters high when your characters are hitting high levels. Every month on the Sly Flourish Patreon, I put up a Patreon Q&A. Any Sly Flourish patron can ask any RPG-related question. Some of those questions become the catalyst for articles or videos on their own. Other ones I bring here to the show, and we talk about. Today, Michael S., great name, says, how can I get my players to speak up more in-game to make more proactive choice rather than reactive? I would say most often they're almost too polite when I, the DM, am describing scenes and situations. This often leads to them sitting idly by waiting for me to finish. So one question, I think we talked about this a little bit on Patreon, was whether or not you were playing online or whether you were playing in person. And I think one thing that the last few years have taught us is that online, we almost always keep our mouths shut because we don't want to talk over other people because of how disruptive that can be for online play. One thing that you can do to counteract that for online play is to call upon specific people. I actually have an article on Sly Flourish about this as well that I will link. But you know, instead of saying like, who has an idea, call on somebody. Now, you don't want to necessarily do that all the time. Last night, for example, I did Campfire Tales. I don't think Campfire Tales work particularly well when you call on somebody when they weren't ready. So I will often say, does anybody want to start? And then I'll start picking people. But when you're playing online in particular, and I think you mentioned in Patreon that, in fact, you were playing online. One thing is to directly talk about it, to say like, hey, you know, feel free to jump in. And Ginny D actually has a really good video about ways that people can give the signal that they want to talk without necessarily disrupting the talker. So I will link to that as well. That's another really good video that talks about this particular problem for online play. But when you're playing online, it is very common because everybody's been on Zoom calls and they've heard how disrupted it is when people are talking over one another. So a lot of times people are going to stay quiet just because they don't want to talk over somebody else. The best approach that I have seen to solve this is to call upon specific players to say anything. And you can kind of ask like, hey, you know, so-and-so, how do you feel about this? How do you feel? You know, call on individual players when you're doing it. But then the other trick is you can have the conversation with them. By the way, feel free. A lot of times, you know, if you have a thought, jump in. Now, of course, you might get the opposite problem with online play with it. If you do say, hey, I want you to jump in, then they will. And then it could disrupt play. So you probably want to be careful with that, but you might come up with another system, like in a text chat, having somebody raise their hand in a text chat, like Zoom calls do this and other things do this, where there's like a way for people to say, hey, I'd like to speak without necessarily interrupting the speaker. If you're playing with video, having somebody just raise their hand and you see it, that can be an approach. There are other possible approaches that you can take. But I'm going to link to both that article about calling on individual players and the video that Ginny D did, really excellent video about the good behaviors for online gameplay that I think can help in this particular situation, particularly when you're playing online. Peter S. says, I like the idea of long epic campaigns with wide scope and stories that evolve and change together with the characters. But when the campaign reaches level 10, I begin to think about the next one. I don't think it's about the complexity of higher tier games. It's that I get bored of the story I am playing. Do you have any recommendations on how to keep the DM interest high during long-term campaigns, like more than 30 sessions? Yes, you can kind of just change the campaign. So if you're getting excited for another kind of story, is there a way you can move into that other kind of story or into a different kind of story so that the campaign itself begins to shift? Can you change its style a little bit? Think about like Tomb of Annihilation, where the first half of the campaign is all about hex crawling across the jungles. And then the second half is delving into a big multi-level killer dungeon. Those are very different kinds of campaigns that are kind of stacked next to each other. The same thing with like Curse of Strahd. Curse of Strahd, most of the game is taking place out in Barovia. You're going from place to place, you're doing certain things, and then suddenly you're in Castle Ravenloft, and now you're exploring Castle Ravenloft, and that's a different kind of game. One of the ways that you could stay interested in your current campaign is to change the campaign. Change the style, change the theme, change the direction, change the story without going too much, because like the players are also invested in the story that you're running. So you don't want to do it so much that they're like, wow, this isn't even the same game anymore. But try to find a way that you can change the current campaign to make it as interesting as if you were running a brand new campaign. Some campaigns, like the ones that I mentioned, have this sort of built in. My Empire of the Ghouls game, which is now hitting 70 sessions, has changed enough all throughout me running it that I've stayed interested because each part of it is almost like a whole new campaign. So what's a way for you to kind of pivot your campaign in a way that the players are going to be excited about? And you could talk to them about this too. You have a conversation with them about it. But they get to use the same characters. They get to stay on. There are elements of the main story that are still going on. That's something I would do. But and it's true for adventures too. Like find the parts of the adventures that you're really excited about and dig into those. So are there angles that your current campaign is heading towards that you're really excited about? How do you kind of pivot and focus on those elements of the campaign and kind of shed the ones that you weren't that excited about? That's what I would do. Friends, I want to thank all of you for hanging out with me today while we talked about all things in tabletop role-playing games. If you enjoyed this show, the best way to keep in touch with all of the stuff that I do is to subscribe to the Sly Flourish newsletter. You get a free adventure generator PDF, and you get a weekly RPG-related email sent directly to your inbox every week. It is absolutely free to sign up. There is a link for that in the show notes. You can also become a patron of Sly Flourish. Patrons get access to stuff like Uncovered Secrets Volume 2, like the 1D100 Monuments, and the 300 different Dungeon Chamber tables, but they get access to a whole lot of other stuff as well. You can also pick up any of my books over at the Sly Flourish bookstore, including Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, Lazy DM's Workbook, Lazy DM's Companion, and Forge of Foes. Those are all available. Thank you all so much. Have a great day, and get out there and play an RPG. Bye-bye.